Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
We're very happy to continue our weekly feature on the Roundtable entitled Ideas Matter, checking in with the public humanities. It is our chance to see what's happening in the humanities councils throughout our seven-state area to discuss important ideas and, yes, why they do indeed matter. This morning, we key in on the environmental history of New York State and focus in on the New York State Council of the Humanities, the effect of the environment on culture and environmental conservation. The topic is related to the Council's new Community Conversations on Environmental Stewardship. To tell us more, we welcome David Stradling, Professor of History at the University of Cincinnati. David, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
Great pleasure. David teaches urban and environmental history at the University of Cincinnati, where his research is focused on issues such as air quality and the effects of urbanization. One of his recent books is The Nature of New York, an Environmental History of the Empire State. So tell us a little bit about that book and how you came to work on it, to look at this environmental history.
Well, it was actually a gift to me to work on this project, given to me by the University of Cornell Press. They had it in their minds that they would like to expand their offerings in environmental history and New York State history, too. It became a natural topic for me. I had recently finished a book on the Catskill Mountains' relationship to New York City called Making Mountains, and because one of the editors was aware of that book, she invited me to take on this broader topic of New York State's environmental history, and I was really happy to do so, just given the diversity of topics that really strike environmental historians as fundamentally important to understanding how the environment has affected the United States.
You can probably say this about any state, but it seems like New York is one in particular of how diverse it is when you think of a natural history, from New York City to the Adirondacks to the central portion of the state to, you know, up to Niagara Falls, for goodness sakes. It's amazing when you think of how rich it is.
Absolutely, and that's one of the reasons why this book became so attractive to me. It's not just that the physical landscape is so diverse, which it is, but also the cultural landscape, being home, obviously, to the largest city in the United States, one of the largest in the world, and all of the urban challenges that come with that, all of the environmental issues that run through big cities, but also home to one of the nation's very first preserved wildernesses. There are very few places that contain the richness of the stories like New York City, New York State does. And the other thing that really attracted me is just the diversity of the people, the really important people from Thomas Cole and the Hudson River landscape artists through the Roosevelts and their efforts for conservation, all the way up to Lois Gibbs and the battle to clean up Love Canal.
What were you looking for in stories, in specific stories? Because it sounds like people actually had a lot to do with it.
Yes. Mostly the way to my process of selecting the things that would wind up in the book were both places and people who could help me connect to themes in environmental history that affect more than just New York State. So although all of the stories are very important to understanding how the state has functioned and evolved over time, they all also illuminate broader themes like the development of the conservation movement in the early 20th century, the importance of environmental activism in the late 20th century, the importance of culture in developing a connection to the landscape. You know, all of these things were really what drove me to thinking about what I would focus on.
When it comes to the natural landmarks, give us a sense of how it mirrors and shows our sense of identity, of what it means to be a New Yorker.
Yeah. You know, I've been thinking about this issue for a long time, and it's interesting that these days tourism seems to be such a market-driven process. And although that's not entirely new, I think New Yorkers are so used to seeing some of the great natural landmarks in marketing campaigns, particularly Niagara Falls, and this has happened so much that we almost forget that it is, in fact, still a natural place. But I think for most people, the landmarks that matter most are the ones that they are personally connected to. This is in New York State. That means it depends on where you live. For some farmers, it is, in fact, the acreage that they work, that these are the natural landmarks that matter most. For some downstate people, it's the connection to the neighborhood park. To upstate people, perhaps it's the broader woods of the Adirondacks. I'm struck as a historian by the difference in the creation of these landmarks, the ones that really have cultural resonance from the 19th century into our own time. One of the most fascinating places to me in New York State is a place called Catterskill Falls, which for a lot of New Yorkers may not be on their radar at all. They may not know that it exists. It's a relatively small falls. It has very little water going over it. Near the Catskill Escarpment near Palinville. So many of your listeners may be aware of it, but downstate folks probably not. But in the 19th century, it was a terribly discussed place. The great writers of the time visited Catterskill Falls, the great artists from Cole and Durand. They all went to Catterskill Falls and made lovely canvases of this place. It was really selected as an important natural spot, largely by its proximity to the Hudson River, which of course connected the Catskill Mountains down to New York City, and so it was a place that lots of people could visit, or at least contemplate visiting.
Is it interesting to you as to what becomes culturally significant?
Yeah, absolutely. The changing times, and in fact, the place right next to the Catterskill Falls, which was also very important, was the Catskill Mountain House, and its overlook, which for most of the 19th century, there was a nice hotel there, only open in the summer, where people would visit and wake up very early in the morning so that they could watch the sunrise come up over the Berkshire Mountains in Massachusetts and watch the changing skies over the Hudson Valley. You could see the river for some stretch there, still can. So this was a place where a lot of Europeans would come and visit. That was the place to see the American landscape. Again, very close, very accessible to New York City. New Yorkers with any kind of means would try and take a trip up there. But now, when you go, it's still just as lovely. The hotel has long been gone. New York State burned it down a long time ago and replaced it with a campground. So we get a sense from just this spot of the way that culture mediates landscapes, that there was a time when this was the ideal place to put a fine tourist hotel, and now it's a very good spot for a lovely campground.
You also explore how New Yorkers have acted on their attachment to their environment by shaping the environmental movement. So give us an example of that in action.
Okay. I think one of the most important stories that runs through in New York State's history involves the Storm King Mountain, which is actually not too far away from the places that I've just been discussing. I'm sure most of your listeners are aware of where it is, right along the Hudson River in the Highlands. In 1962, the Con Edison, the big power company down in New York City, had designs on putting a power plant there that would involve pumping water up from the river at night when power demands were low, and then letting the water run back through turbines during the day when power demands were higher. And although this would be we would call this a zero-emission power plant, it also generated no net power. It just takes the same amount of power to get the water up as it does to get it back down through the turbine. But what it would do is scar this very beautiful stone mountain that reaches down into the Hudson River in a very beautiful part of the Highlands. And so what develops around the reaction here is a very diverse movement to prevent Con Ed from being able to build the power plant, making a variety of arguments, some of them purely aesthetic, that this would simply mar a beautiful place, some of them having to do with more traditional conservation issues, like the destruction of fish stocks, because the turbines would suck up small fry that would be destroyed through the process. And eventually, this movement of people as diverse as Lawrence Rockefeller, very wealthy man, obviously, and Pete Seeger, more radical voices, came together to delay the building of Storm King so long that other voices of concern came together, and eventually New York City itself became opposed to building Storm King. It's a very important story. It lasts for 20 years, really, before Con Ed finally completely gives up on building the power plant. And it tells us a lot about the diversity of environmental interests. You know, Con Edison had a difficult time trying to figure out how it would supply power to New York City without creating an air pollution problem. But here was an instance where lots of different kinds of New Yorkers came together and said that the sacrifice here at Storm King would be too great.
So I would love to think that that is a story that would prevent other things from happening and to allow important environmental projects to take place, and you say, oh, well, something like that could never happen again.
Yeah, and in fact, that's not the case.
Right.
Right, they're just constant.
We don't learn that lesson, do we?
No, we really don't. I mean, I think this is just part of, you know, what it is to live in a wealthy nation where we have high expectations for job creation, for wealth creation. All of these things were constantly going to pose challenges to our natural environment. I think there's no way around that. The question is, do we take stock of the threats that might be posed from some development or another before that development goes forward? I think the best example right now involves fracking. And the difference between New York State's approach to fracking and Pennsylvania's approach to fracking is very instructive. That Pennsylvania, that has this long history of energy extraction, a very powerful and important coal industry, oil industry too, they have a culture that has developed around the idea that this is what drives their economy.
Right.
It's very important for the industry. It's important for the people who work in those extraction fields too. And they have gone headlong into fracking. So has my current state, Ohio, been very willing to accept the potential threats of fracking. But New York State, with a much more complex political structure, more voices at the table, more complex environment as far as the tourism is concerned, the importance of tourism and farming still. I think all of these voices have forced the state to be more cautious. And in fact, that's one of the lessons of Storm King, I think, is that the longer we have to think about, to really study the implications for a major change, the better understanding we'll have. And even if fracking takes place in New York State, it will be done better for the delay that has taken place.
We have been talking to David Stradling, professor of history at the University of Cincinnati, and we, of course, are focusing in on the New York Council of Humanities and their new community conversations on environmental stewardship. You can find out more information by going to nyhumanities.org, nyhumanities.org, for information about David's work and about the council and, of course, about Ideas Matter. David Stradling, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you. Take care. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.